Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 and goes out every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. here on BCFM 93.2. This week, young filmmaker Jake Bex, who's making a film possibly for the internet and possibly for your TV screens, called Bilderberg The Movie. Plus, down at the Avon Valley Railway over Christmas and the New Year, and into the New Year, all sorts of interesting things going on. We speak to David Cole. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol. And their office is just off Queen Square. You can contact them at the end of the show or give a phone number, and it's volunteeringbristol.org.uk. But first, I'm joined by Jake Bex. Hi, Jake. Welcome to Dialect.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Tell us a bit about how you got interested in actually making films online, because I know for years and years, really, it was only the TV companies that had the technology to do this. It was extremely difficult to get hold of. Now, for maybe £200-300, you can buy a laptop, you can get a bit of software, you can get a camera on your phone, for goodness sake. Some of them are high definition, really good, you know, and actually usable to make an internet documentary. And you can do it yourself. So how did you first get interested in trying to do this?
Well, it was back in January I decided. I've been thinking about it for a long time, about making a film. And documentary is always the medium that I've always wanted to explore. Excuse me. But then, yeah, back in January, I just turned 27, and I was like, you know what, why not now? Let's just go out and do it. And I'm lucky enough to work in a place where that kind of stuff is like easily accessible.
When you say that kind of stuff, do you mean the equipment to do that sort of thing?
Yeah, definitely.
So how have you managed to get access to editing equipment, or have you bought your own bits and pieces, or what? How's that?
I slowly started to build up a collection. I got the laptop. I'd had a laptop for a while. Then I bought the camera. On the cheap, and then a friend of mine hooked me up with some software to edit, and that's basically all I needed.
Okay, so let's start with the laptop. Any tips for if you're getting hold of a laptop? Does it make any difference what the make is, what the power of the processor, the memory, all this kind of thing?
It does matter. I mean, if you go for an older laptop, it's going to run slow. I mean, it'll still do the job, but it'll do it at a lot slower pace. But yeah, the higher the, you know, the RAM, the random access memory, or the processing speed, the easier it's going to be for you in the long run.
So I guess the idea is to try and buy something fairly new and reasonably priced, sort of mid price, so you're going to have quite a lot of wriggle room when it comes to, you know, doing all the processing of the video pictures and that kind of thing. Okay, what about a camera? How did you decide what kind of camera you were going to need?
The camera that I had, it was the only one available to me, and I needed one pretty quickly, and you know, it had a video function on it. The camera that I'm using is a Canon 1100D, which for any photography expert knows that this is a very basic camera. It's not for making films, it's not for doing that, but it has a video function.
Now, has it? This is one that's actually looks like a stills camera, but it does actually record video too, is it?
It does, yes. The one that came out before it, I did a bit of research into it, was the 1100, which didn't have a video function. But this one, it came to me and I was like, right, I'll take it, you know. And that's all I needed, as long as it did video, I didn't care what kind of camera it was.
Now, the only thing I'd say, having had a little bit of experience with this, I mean, the first bit of footage that I really ever shot was on a Hi8. Now, that's an analog. There used to be something called 8mm video, which was a little, you know, reel-to-reel tape inside your video camera. And Hi8 was what is called high band. So it was actually double the amount of information stored by the camera onto the tape. So, but this is analog. This is an old-fashioned tape. Is yours? I take it anyway. Right. That yours is digital.
All digital, yes.
Now, the other thing, when I was getting my Hi8 was, I've got to be able to have independent input, sound input. So you've got to have a camera which has got, you know, where you can set up a microphone and you can really make sure you've got really good quality sound, because built-in microphones on cameras are notoriously awful.
Terrible. The one on mine is absolutely horrendous. So I had to go out and get a separate sound piece of sound equipment, Zoom H1.
Oh, okay, yes, yeah. That's what we use here at BCFM.
Oh, really?
Actually, quite a lot, yeah. They're very nice. They're also good for recording bands, for recording music, that sort of thing.
You can mess with the levels on the back, and there's only like 3 switches on the back as well, so there's not a lot of work goes into it.
So, once you've got good quality sound, good quality video, was it difficult to learn how to do things like focusing, depth of field, and all this thing? Because a camera's quite a complicated bit of kit, the lens, isn't it?
It is. I taught myself the basics. I went into this thinking, do you know what, if I'm going to make film, I'm just going to make film. I'm not going to go to film school. I'm not going to do all that stuff. I'm just going to dive straight in. If I need to figure out something on the camera, I'll just go on Google.
Or not necessarily Google, your own favourite search engine. Not necessarily Google.
My own favourite search engine.
Especially since Google have been tax avoidancing, and everyone is. It's entered the language like the word Hoover did in the 1950s.
Is it in the dictionary?
60s.
I don't know.
Almost certainly, So you've managed to get all that sort of stuff together. What about the software? Because this is probably the most crucial decision you're going to make as to which software to plump for.
Again, I wasn't really precious with it. I use Sony Vegas Pro. It was just the one that was a friend gave it to me. I was like, yeah, I'll use it. It's like a lot of people, when I talk about my editing software, they're like, what, you don't use Final Cut Pro? I'm like,
ew.
Yeah, it's like, what, no. This is the one that was given to me. That's the one I'm going to use,
Okay, does it do the job? How do you go about actually deciding where to start? And I suppose in a minute we might have to even talk about your subject matter, but physically, how do you decide how to start doing your film? The opening sequence, do you do it like that? Do you start from actually the very beginning of the film, or are you assembling bits of it and then putting it together?
To be quite honest with you, I'm still trying to figure that out myself. I've tried doing it from start to finish, but that wasn't working out. So now what I've decided to do is split the film up into chapters, and then take from all the interviews I've done, I'll take what they're talking about and put them into certain chapters, and then when the time comes, I'll throw all them chapters together, and then hopefully what I will have is a final product.
Okay, well, just as an example, we'll have a listen now to an internet documentary. As far as I know, as many of these, however excellent they are, don't get shown on mainstream TV anymore, which is a whole other story, but maybe we can talk about that in a minute. This particular one is called The Power Behind the New World Order. Well, a lot of people, as soon as they hear the word New World or words New World Order, will just switch off because this is seen to be conspiracy theory, etc. What are your thoughts about that, Jake?
Well, when I got into this whole thing, I was very much, I just dove in headfirst. But then after a while, it's like, right, okay, let's just take a step back because it's getting a bit crazy. And now I kind of just look at the bigger picture of this whole New World Order thing. Is it happening? I don't know. I can't prove it.
That's the whole point, is you can't. But the thing is, there is a very powerful force in the West, which is a commercial force, and it might be just to do with money. It's difficult to know what the motivation for the rich and powerful elite are. And this is the thing, for me, there actually is some substance to this New World Order, whatever you want to call it, is that you've got impunity. You've got people who are so powerful, so rich, that the law doesn't touch them. We've got, countless bankers, directors of banks, managers of banks, and traders who should have been jailed and prosecuted for all the various frauds, the LIBOR fraud, payment protection insurance fraud, money laundering that the banks have been doing, and yet none of them have gone to jail. They get out-of-court settlements and fines, and the bank pays them. The people who've actually done these crimes don't suffer at all. So with that kind of impunity and an elite around, it's a very dangerous situation. I mean, you'll get maybe somebody like this chap in the riots who stole a bottle of water and then got several months in jail. And yet people who are committing mass fraud right across the Western world, stealing money from people's mortgage pockets through fraud, absolutely nothing happens to them. Anyway, okay. So that's my little two-halfpence on the New World Order. Whether it exists or not, we don't know. But anyway, this is an Irish filmmaker, a little extract from the film, the opening, in fact, of the film that he made, The Power Behind the New World Order.
This movie, which would have been an exposure of this Carnegie Endowment story and the Ford Foundation, and the Guggenheim and the Rockefeller Foundation, all working in harmony toward the control of education in the United States.
Mm-hmm. believe, first of all, that we now need nothing short of a world constitution for the global financial system.
This is a global economic crisis. All they're doing, country after country, is dumping money into the problem, and it's all falling on the taxpayers' back.
It is a move against truth. It is a move against meaning, and a move against certainty. There's no such thing as truth. You cannot find meaning in life. You've got to manufacture it yourself, and you can't be certain about anything. But they obviously are certain about no meaning and certain about no truth. So they bring in that certainty to suit themselves. Now, there's no truth, no meaning, no certainty. There's another aspect to this. They take away from the author the prerogative of fusing words with his or her own meaning. So if you write a book, the postmodernists will read it and deconstruct it to reinterpret what they think you ought to have said or what they want to make you actually say.
I believe you and I are being plunged into a period of time about which the Bible says more than it does about any other period of time in history, including the time that Jesus walked the shores of Galilee.
And the message that I am bringing you is clear. It is concise. And there can be no mistake in its interpretation. You must wake up now or be enslaved. The war has begun many years ago. The war was declared by our enemies upon us. You had better listen.
Her externalization of the hierarchy. And she tells us that in place of Christianity, the mystery religions will be restored by the church and Freemasonry. Many of us Christians are not afraid to be thrown into prison because we realize that we are free in Christ no matter where we are. And they are the slaves, no matter where they are, because they're slaves to sin.
Well, there's a bit of a Christian angle there, which is slightly annoying. I mean, the whole point really being the Nelson Mandela celebrations was he was prepared to die for what he believed in. I mean, this is certainly not just a prerogative of Christianity. But anyway, Jake, what do you make of that sort of thing? I mean, we had a little bit of Bill Cooper in the middle of that. Does it frustrate you, inspire you, or what?
It does frustrate me a little bit. Anything you watch to do with this subject is very much like that. You can't find anything different anywhere. I certainly haven't found anything different. I mean, the reason why I started to make this film, the reason I'm doing it now, is I want to repackage it. I want to repackage the whole New World Order. Oh, I sound silly. I'm not using this terminology.
You don't want to use it. No, you don't think it's helpful.
I don't think it is at all. I could happily sit and watch something like that. But what I'm trying to do is repackage it and, you know, aim it at a different person, because films like this, I think, are made for people who, you know, really do believe in this stuff. So they're just preaching to the converted. What I'm trying to do is kind of repackage it and, you know, make it a little bit funny, you know, make it humorous, so people can latch onto it. Much like, I mean, I'll use this as an example. Charlie Skelton, when he started writing for The Guardian about Bilderberg, he took it from a comedy angle and people latched onto it, you know.
Well, let's move on then to discuss this whole subject, the Bilderberg, the movie, which is this film you want to make. Now, I mean, I've been researching these people ever since I left the BBC years ago, mid and early 1990s. What attracted you to the Bilderberg conferences then? What was it that made you, you know, latch onto that?
I don't remember the exact moment that I found out about them. I was, like I said before, I was heavily into all this kind of stuff, the New World Order and the 9/11s and the JFKs and the whatever, you know, down that rabbit hole. And then this thing came up, this group of people that meet up every year. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. So I kind of, and you know, I've kind of let everything else go, and this has kind of been the thing that I've, you know, spending my time on.
Without telling us too much about your film, what are the things that you've found out in your journey in making the film in the first place?
I didn't set out doing this film to find anything out. I mean, I think I know what I already want to know.
I mean, for example, who have you interviewed?
Dennis Healy would be top billing, I think, on the poster.
Because he was one of the sort of founders of this.
He was the founders. He was at the first meeting. He went 40 years
solid.
This
is in 1956? 54.
54, yes. And he went for 40 years till 94. And he very graciously invited me to his house in East Sussex, and went down there, interviewed him, and it was a very bizarre experience.
But did you learn anything from Dennis? Or did you say you thought you knew most quite a lot about it?
Well, I mean, the angle that I want to take on my film, I want to, you know, I just want to cover the basics.
Do you think that when you're making this film, do you think what you're doing is you've done the research beforehand, you pretty much know what you want to say. So when you're going out to get the interviews, you're just simply putting together, it's almost like putting jigsaw pieces together that you already know about.
Pretty much, yeah. You know, I've got the picture, you know, on the box, and I know exactly what I'm aiming for. And if I uncover something else, you know, along the way, then all the better. But, you know, I kind of, like I said before, I already know what I want and how I want it.
And I suppose it's the thing that interests me about why you do what you do is, I mean, I'm just like you. I will watch a documentary on the TV sometimes and think, gosh, that's so annoying that they've brought this little thing in here and it's kind of poisoned it for me. And, you know, rather than throw things at the TV screen, your answer is that, look, I'm going to do my own version. I'm going to do it properly.
Yeah, well, to say I'm doing it properly, you know, I'm still, you know, this is like my first feature film. I have dabbled in a couple of other bits. But I think the whole New World Order thing, and I hate saying it, but it needs repackaging like that with that.
Okay, well, what would you call it then? Have you come up with something else that you could call the power elite of the West ruling over our politicians so that the elections mean little nowadays? I mean, how do you say it?
I don't know how I would describe it. It's just, you know, my eyes have been on Bilderberg for the last couple of years now, and that's all I've been focused on. Are they trying to take over the world? Maybe. I mean, the right people are there to do it. But can we prove it? No, we can't. But what I want to do is, like I said, repackage the whole thing. Like, with the clip you just showed, the, you know, dramatic music and it's all... Whereas I just want to make fun of it a little bit.
You mentioned Charlie, didn't you? Charlie Skelton.
Charlie Skelton, yes.
Yeah, he's an excellent writer and a freelance writer and has done stuff for The Guardian. He's also a comedy writer with... isn't it Jimmy Carr, I think?
Yeah, he does Lay Out 10 Cats and Tentacle Life.
And, he takes a fantastic angle on it all. The thing I always remember from Charlie's take on the Bilderbergs, when he was talking about, they were taking photographs of this conference, which is all sealed off. I mean, you know, that's what they do, basically. You get 120 of the richest, most powerful people in the NATO countries, all in the same room. And this has been going on since 1950s. And they don't want anyone to even know who's in there. Even though they release a list of people, you know, they're trying to stop anyone with a camera taking photographs through the windows of the hotel or whatever. Which does suggest, doesn't it, that maybe there are people in there who are not on the list.
Oh, definitely.
You think so?
Yeah.
What makes you say that?
It's from things that I've heard, you know, it's like, why would they release everybody that's supposed
to be
there?
Well, I can tell you something. From 1998, I covered that. That was a Bilderberg conference that took place in Scotland. And I went up there about a week afterwards and met with a woman who had been working as a temp in the hotel through the Bilderberg conference weekend. And had a little, you know, this is one of the best ways of getting information out of these conferences, of course, is talking to the staff of the hotels. And she explained to me that she'd served Tony Blair his breakfast on Saturday morning. Now, he is not on the list of the 1998 Bilderberg conference. He was the British Prime Minister at the time, and he was there in secret. So, you know, there is something suspicious. If they don't want to say that someone's going to be there, and they are there. Cameron, for example, the Bilderberg conference that took place this year. In June, wasn't it, Watford...
Yes.
David Cameron couldn't resist it, could he? Yeah. He wasn't on the official list, but he couldn't resist going down to hobnob with Henry Kissinger, David Rockefeller, and all the rest of these super rich.
That made
super
the news
rich.
As well. I was very surprised that, you know.
Well, there's been more coverage over the years, hasn't there? Slowly but surely, bit by bit. I mean, not a lot of detailed coverage of, you know, who these people are. One thing we never get on the news about Bilderberg is the way that the very first conference, for the first 20 years or so, the conferences were chaired by a former SS officer, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands. He was in the SS when he was after he left college. He was in the Nazi party when he was at college, and then he decided, I'm not interested in the Nazis anymore. But then he was the chairman of this conference for 20 years until he was disgraced in 1975, I think.
Lockheed?
The Lockheed scandal.
I think it was 76.
76, thank you for correcting me. I don't know how much you know about that, but it was a... A chambermaid in his hotel found a bit of paper in his rubbish bin after he'd left the room, and it had all sorts of details about a $1 million bribe that he'd taken from Lockheed, the US aircraft manufacturers, to this money was basically to bribe him to persuade the Dutch Air Force to buy Lockheed Starfighter jets. And so he was caught out, you know. This is the guy that we're supposed to trust these people. They say, oh, we meet in secret, but you can trust us. Just give us a taste of what your film is going to look like, Jake.
Speaking of that, I mean, that's one of the things that I kind of stumbled across. I didn't know anything about it up until I started doing the film, and I was like, oh, what's this? You know, they actually missed a year. The Bilderberg didn't meet for that 1 year because Prince Bernard was tied up in all this, you know, all this mess. I'm just basically going to cover the basics. That's all I want to do. I just want to show people who these people are, why they meet, where they meet, when they meet, and just, you know, then go with it. You know, go and do your own research into these people. These are very, very powerful people, and they meet up. Nobody knows about it. Why?
Well, what makes you think they're so powerful? I mean, it's just a bunch of 120 people. I mean, I look at the list and I think most of the names I've never even heard of. The head of, I don't know, the European Central Bank. I wouldn't know what his name was if it wasn't there on the list.
I suppose you don't have to know his name. You just got to know that this person runs the European Central Bank. And, you know, these people, what do they talk about inside this building? Because, like, you look at the coincidences. Like, I mean, George Osborne, our Chancellor, and Mark Carney, the former head of the Bank of Canada, they've been going for years. All of a sudden, Mark Carney's our Governor of the Bank of England. Was this brought up in one of these meetings? You know, is there a bit of back scratching going on?
Well, the other thing, of course, is we just had the Chancellor's autumn statement last week. Now, the only person that really gets to speak at length on the radio and is commented on by the newspapers is Ed Balls, the Shadow Chancellor. Now, the irony here is that both George Osborne and Ed Balls are both members of the Bilderberg conferences. They've both been going many years. And so you do start to wonder, are we getting Labour Party economic policy? Are we getting Conservative Party economic policy? Are we just getting Bilderberg economic policy?
Who knows? That's the whole thing. I mean, Ed Balls has only ever been twice. When he went this year, that was his second time. And what I find funny is that Michael Meacher brought up a very important question in Parliament.
No, that's right. He's a Labour MP who's taken an interest in this. In fact, he got it discussed in a little debate, didn't he, in the House of Commons?
He brought up, I think it's called an urgent question with the Speaker, and he brought it up to Kenneth Clark.
But he asked George Osborne to answer the questions, and George said no.
Yeah, so Ken Clark had to step in, the more senior Bilderberg member.
This is the man that's just dismantled our legal aid system.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's right. Like, so, for example, if you get sacked by, if you're pregnant and you get sacked because you're pregnant, then now you have to stump up the thousands of pounds that it's going to cost to try and take your employer to court. Whereas before Ken Clark decided to do that, that was all paid for by the government. So this is, okay, Ken Clark took over from George. Maybe George wasn't quite good enough.
Ken Clark's the more senior Bilderberg member. He sits on the steering committee, so he's got...
Hang on, isn't he now a junior minister or a backbencher or something? I'm not sure. He's not as important as the Chancellor.
No, he's a minister without portfolio, I think.
Oh, of course, yes. That was a job that Mandelson had as well, and of course he was a Bilderberger.
He still goes, yeah. In fact, I think we saw him with his window down this year going in, because a lot of these people go in their cars down the driveway with their, you know, tinted windows up or papers over their face, but we saw Mandelson. I think there's a picture of him somewhere.
The Prince of Darkness.
Yeah.
Supposedly. But, I mean, he's one of these kind of strange characters from the Labour Party that seems like he's in the wrong party. He's just... Most of his... He was only saying, I'm incredibly comfortable about being filthy rich. Something like that. Doesn't sound like a sort of Labour Party...
It sounds like something he would say. But he's got his fingers in so many different pies. The same as Clark. You know, they've all got their hands in different things and, you know, they're not just... You know, the MPs that they say they are, they go out into business and they've got interests elsewhere.
I think one of the main problems with all this, though, is that you've got politicians, as they step into these meetings, what they're doing is they're swearing an oath of secrecy. They're saying, we will not mention any conversations that happen in this place outside, and we certainly won't reference who said what or anything. Now, these are our elected politicians. Should they really be going into a meeting and swearing an oath of secrecy as they step in?
No, they shouldn't. No. They I've had different different responses to this question, but I've asked numerous MPs and members of Bilderberg. You know, it's like, why do you go? What happens there? And they'll say, oh, it's just a private meeting and it's not on public funds or whatever. And then other people say, yep, I got a freedom of information request saying George Osborne was there in his official capacity as Chancellor. And I'm thinking, well, why isn't this in the news?
Hang on. So he said there in his official capacity as Chancellor of Exchequer.
This is from the 2011 meeting. You can presume it's every year, but the freedom of information documents that I have, which I will be showing the audience in my film, he basically... It says that he was there as in his official capacity as Chancellor.
And so can you find out from him, from his office, what was discussed, agreed, or anything like that?
I was locked in a 3-year battle for information. I only got the information this year. No, sorry, two years.
2 years of freedom of information. Yeah. Now tell us how those freedom of information requests work then. You have to just send one into the Treasury, do you?
Yes, that is that simple. You just if you want information from anywhere, any public body, just send them an email or a letter saying under the Freedom of Information Act I would like to request this information, and they have a certain amount of time to get back to you. If you don't like their response, you can reply back to them and say, look, I'm not happy with this response, I'd like an internal review. So take a couple of months for an internal review, and if you don't like that response, then you go to the commissioner's office, which is where I took it.
Well, look, there are thousands of fascinating sort of conspiracies, crop circles, goodness knows what, that people get into. Why did you choose this one rather than something else?
Why Bilderberg? It's because Bilderberg, I've always said, is a very tangible thing. You know, the crop circles, the 9/11 stuff, it's all speculation as to who was behind whatever. But Bilderberg, you can go to these meetings. Not to the meetings, but you can go outside these meetings.
You might get come a cropper with the bouncers, but you...
Exactly, yeah. You can go and you know, bump fists with the police and stuff, you know, that are protecting these people. And you can see the cars go in and... So Etienne Davignon go in with his window down, or like... Yep,
so
I'm here.
Who's he? Hang on, I've never heard of him.
He is I think he's the honorary chairman.
This is what bothers me, is that these people who are the richest and most powerful in the Western world, mostly the NATO countries, most of them we've never heard their names before. We don't see them on the TV. What the hell is going on?
They just hold and wield an awful lot of power and an awful lot of money, and they don't just have the one job. They'll you know, go into loads of different jobs, and they'll back scratch, and you know, everyone's friends with everyone else. And
but you spoke to Dennis Healy, who obviously been for many years. Yes. Did he give you any idea about actually what they talk about?
Not directly.
He wouldn't quote anybody, I suppose, because he's sworn the oath of the Chatham House rules.
Well, speaking of the secrecy thing, another thing in the film is going to be about Mayor Dorothy Thornhill, the mayor of Watford. But more on that a bit later on. But yeah, no, Dennis Healy. Yeah, he didn't really say an awful lot. I was kind of hoping he would. I was, you know, the guy's 95 years old, and I'm thinking...
If you're going to tell anyone, Dennis, tell him now.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was thinking. But I went in there, you know, I'd still consider myself an amateur filmmaker, and here I am at Dennis Healy's house, who's been interviewed by the likes of Sir David Frost and Michael Parkinson, whoever, you know, and there I am, you know, interviewing the former Chancellor of the Exchequer, the former Defence Minister, and Bilderberg member for 40 years, and I was honestly out of my depth. You know, the guy can answer questions very, very well.
But what about the media, though? Because that's the thing, and again, another really dodgy thing about the Bilderberg is you've got people like Marcus Agius, who's on the executive board of the BBC, in there swearing his little secret oath.
Former head of Barclays?
Yeah. Yes, he had to leave, didn't he, after all this LIBOR stuff we were talking about earlier. You know, the fraud, Marcus. Yes, the fraud. And I mean, it's like one of the ways I was asked to talk about it on Three Counties Radio, which is that covers Watford this year. And the only term I could come up to describe them is a Bond villains convention. Because most of these people really do come across like that. They come across as quite creepy. You know, the Mandelsons of this world. But anyway, the media side of it is rather worrying. And we had, for example, Rupert Murdoch's general manager, his chief executive, basically, for News International, was going to these Bilderberg conferences. You know, heads of TV networks right around Europe, like in Italy, Spain, places like that. Big national daily newspapers. There's I think his name's Marcus Wolf. Maybe you can correct me, from the Financial Times here in Britain. There are all sorts of extremely powerful types, including the big financial hitters like David Rockefeller. Now, the reason I point him out is because they were an oil family in the United States, the Rockefellers. They had a company called Standard Oil, which basically started taking over and monopolizing all of the oil supplies in the United States back in the early part of the 1900s. And they were controlling everything. They were doing what's called vertical integration. So they weren't just drilling oil. They were also secretly buying up railway companies so they could transport their own oil for free and charge all the other oil people to move their oil around America. They were also buying up the petrol stations, of course, that had Standard Oil on them. And they slowly, by buying up everything, the whole supply chain, from extracting oil, refining it, transporting it, supplying it to the public, they were taking over the entire oil supply of the country, becoming far too powerful, incredibly powerful, like actually the oil companies still are today. Now, why I like talking about David Rockefeller is because, you know, he decided that it was actually easier and better and more profitable to become a banker. So he moved from, their family moved from oil, although they still got fantastic amounts of shares in oil, just as the Queen of the Netherlands, who goes to the Bilderberg too, you know, Royal Dutch Shell Lady, yep. Lady B, or is it the Queen Bee, they Queen call Bee, her, don't yeah. they? Prince, what's her name again? The Queen Beatrix.
Queen Beatrix, yeah. No, Princess Beatrix now.
Oh, she's now, she's yes.
abdicated, yeah.
Yeah, so this is, seems incredible to me that you can be a really powerful oil person and then you say to yourself, well, actually, if I was to, you know, buy a bank, I can actually make money even more easily than buy oil and press a little button, make it like that. You know, basically, that's what they do. And, of course, you don't need to rob a bank if you own it. Anyway, there is one, actually, people might think, was it, where can you get stuff about the Bilderbergs? Is there any sensible stuff? There's an extremely good book called Secrets and Lies by David Southwell. And I'm just going to read now a little extract from the book about the Bilderbergs and what he says about it. David's book, it's a great little sort of coffee table book. And if you're ever bored and you want a conspiracy, he's got a page on every conspiracy you could ever imagine. And this is what he's got to say about Bilderberg. If you ignore the wild conspiracy theories that go hand in hand with most mentions of the Bilderberg Group and concentrate on the facts, the true picture is of a collection of the richest and most powerful people on the planet who meet up once a year. Given the type of coverage a gathering like the annual World Economic Forum meetings in Davos in Switzerland generates, you'd expect that a gathering of world leaders, fast-rising politicians, key military thinkers, press barons, and the richest and most influential business figures on the planet would attract a few journalists. When the 2004 Bilderberg meeting in Italy drew Prime Minister Tony Blair, President George W. Bush, Melinda Gates, the wife of Bill Gates, you would think there would be a press stampede. In fact, there was almost a media blackout of the event. The few papers that mentioned it was due to happen did not send reporting teams to cover it. No major national or international news networks attempted to film it. When people who usually draw journalists to them like moths to a flame can avoid publicity like that, it's fair to say the Bilderberg Group is as secret as such an impressive collection of the world's high and mighty can ever get. Why is such an important meeting underreported? In the 1990s, William Glasgow at Businessweek suggested the reason was simply cost-cutting. After all, we can't afford to cover everything. If you believe that, you believe anything. But a journalist at The Economist, one of the UK's most important magazines, gave an alternative explanation. The Bilderbergers have been removed from our assignment list years ago by executive order. While policies may have changed, business magazines are still lacking the in-depth coverage that most readers would expect a Bilderberg gathering worthy of generating. Of course, there's another reason why journalists don't try to cover the Bilderberg Group meetings. In 1998, one plucky and independent-minded Scottish reporter tried to cover the Bilderberg meeting at the Turnberry Hotel in Ayrshire. For the crime of doing nothing more than asking questions, he was handcuffed by the Strathclyde police like a violent criminal and thrown into jail. So, you covered the meeting at Watford this year, Jake. Were yes. you thrown into jail?
No, I wasn't. Not for lack of trying.
I found when I was down there, I found the police actually being fairly accommodating. I mean, for example, BBC Three turned up, didn't they, to try and do a spoof. Do you remember that?
On the Sunday, yes. I remember. In fact, I think that's going to be on this week, actually. I saw it on the TV.
Well, because they were trying to take the mickey, basically. They had devil's heads, and they were trying to take the mickey out of the people that are protesting against the Bilderberg, rather than against the Bilderbergers themselves.
Correct.
And, they were spotted fairly quickly, and the police inspector that was on site said, are these people causing trouble? And they were actually escorted off the site by the police.
Yep.
Trying to do a kind of reverse psyop. I mean, this is what I suppose you could sort of talk about the postmodern thing. Now, in the old days, someone would be there taking the mickey out of and satirising the Bilderbergs.
Yep.
Now, what they're doing is they're switched completely, and the BBC are satirising the people who are trying to actually sort the world out.
Yep.
So, okay, finally, when do you think we're going to be able to see your film, Jake?
My deadline, I need this finished by the end of January. I'm going to get it ready for film festivals next year. Hopefully a couple of film festivals will pick it up. I didn't want to throw it out on the internet straight away. Sometime, probably around the next Bilderberg meeting, hopefully. Early next summer.
Well, good luck. I hope you manage to do it. And if you stay with us for a little while, we're going to have a bit of music now, and then we're going to talk about what to do with the local railways, the heritage railways in and around Bristol.
Country bus, North Country bus, clumsy and cumbersome rumbus to us. Country bus, North Country bus, though you're a slow coach, you're okay for us. Though your cargo is confusion, sheepmen and cowgirls and chickens galore at the back. No need to hurry, we couldn't care less what the time may be, and there's no call to worry. If you smell a bit, so do we, villainous. Malodor us. Country bus, North Country bus, rollicking, frolicking, uproarious. Country bus, North Country bus, you're rusty and you're dusty, but you're okay for us. Though your seats are rather spartan, we've got the springs in our backsides to ride out your bounce. Though you may stumble after the dance on a Saturday night, backseat lovers don't grumble, they seem to manage all right. Amorous, scandalous. Country bus, North Country bus, lusty and rustic and impetuous. Country bus, North Country bus, bog trotting bumpkin, you're okay for us. Though your progress is uncertain, especially at night when the public house closes its doors, you tend to dodder, staggering home from the Bull Hotel. We never bother, 'cause we've got the staggers as well. Glorious, notorious. Country bus, North Country bus, grunting and chuntering cantankerous. Country bus, North Country bus, but no other bus would be good enough for us. Through the wild, the cruel winter, you get the cold in your eyes and the snow up your nose. But sooner or later, you will turn up in the village square with daffodils in your gaiters and pussy willow in your hair. Wait for us. wait for us. Country bus.
Bristol Community FM 93.2. And that was Jake Thackeray there with Country Bus. Now, the Country Bus connection is, of course, what replaced the railways all over this country. Around about the 1950s, there was all sorts of discussions about North Sea oil, and Britain didn't have really enough money to dig all the North Sea oil out, put oil rigs out there, and the British oil companies. And so at least one of the theories about it all is that the Americans said to the Brits, well, you can get your North Sea oil, but we don't want the North Sea oil to be depressing the world oil price and bringing it down. So you can have the loans for your North Sea oil, but only if you get rid of your railways and have lots and lots of cars. So next time you're trying to park your car in a suburban street and you have to drive half a mile to try and find a parking place, then you can look back at the 1950s and 1960s, and a certain Dr. Richard Beeching, who's the Beeching Report in the 1960s, which led to the close down of most of the important bits, well, the external bits, I suppose, the smaller parts of the British railway network. Well, one good thing about all that, and Beeching, of course, worked on the atomic bomb project, which not very many people know. Atomic Bomber Beeching is a book by Richard Cottrell, if you want to read that. It's on Kindle. I don't think it's available as a print book, but you can read bits of it online, just on the internet, but you can buy it as a Kindle book for about £5-6. Yeah, he was working for, he was a metallurgist, but for some reason, Ernest Marples, the man who owned a road building company called Marples Ridgeway, who was the transport secretary at the time in the 1960s, he decided that he was going to get Mr. Beeching to close these railways down. And that's exactly what he did. But there's still some, the positive side of all this is that we've still got quite a lot of these heritage railways around. And our local one to Bristol is the Avon Valley Railway. There's lots going on over Christmas, the new year, mince pies and things into the new year. And I spoke to David Cole.
My name's David Cole. I'm development manager at the Avon Valley Steam Railway. Santa comes to the Avon Valley Railway every December, and he's extremely popular, obviously, with all the children. So we have roughly around 11,000 people come to see Santa at the Avon Valley Railway every December. And Santa travels on the train with all the children and their adults, and has a word with everyone individually, makes sure they've been good boys and girls, and then gives them a very nice present.
Now, price is around about £10. What days is taking place?
The Santa's started on the 24th of November, which was a Sunday, and from then we're running every Saturday and Sunday up until Christmas, and we're also running on Monday the 23rd and Christmas Eve as well, the 24th. Once Father Christmas has left us on the 24th of December to go and deliver all those presents to the children around the world, he obviously needs to take a break. So on Boxing Day and the following weekend, and also the 1st of January, we then move into the sherry and mince pie season, and all our visitors on those 4 days during the course of their train journey will receive a glass of sherry or a non-alcoholic alternative, because we know there are people out there obviously that are driving, and also a delicious mince pie as well. So that's a nice little way to relax between Christmas and the new year.
Now, I know there's always things going on here. I usually hear clanking noises coming from the shed if I'm having a cup of coffee, as I've just done in your cafe. What's going on here at the moment, development wise
well, at the moment we have long-term plans, of course, to extend the railway to the outskirts of Bath, probably about another 3 miles, so that would double the length of our line from 3 to 6.
Okay, so what are the obstacles in the way of that? Because I know these things are very difficult for heritage railways to get their lines going in both directions a little bit further.
One of the obvious main issues is money, but at the moment what we're looking to do is to continue our discussions with Bath and North East Somerset Council, who own the land that we hope to run on. That's progressing quite well at the moment, but it is a long-term rather than a short-term issue. And of course, all these things, including the planning permissions, do take time to sort out. But we're still hopeful that that will happen. once we actually get permissions, then of course it's down to the actual sort of design and build. And we could be talking millions of pounds to get us into Newbridge, which is where we hope in due course our next station will be.
What about rolling stock here then? Are you restoring anything at the moment? And what can we expect to see over Christmas?
Over the Christmas period, the volunteers are continuing to work on our existing stock to ensure that they're maintained to the highest standards, of course. But also we are working on a number of other locomotives and coaches that will in due course come back into use. One of them is the old Sentinel steam locomotive, the shunter that used to be over at the Fry's chocolate factory, and work is progressing quite well on that. But in due course we will be concentrating on the boiler and hope in the next couple of years maybe that we might actually see the locomotive back in steam, which would be absolutely fantastic.
Your cafe, when's that open? Because people can pop in there pretty much every day, can't they?
The buffet is closed one day of the year, which is Christmas Day. We do let the staff off one day a year. But apart from that, we're back open on Boxing Day, and then it's open 7 days a week through to the following Christmas. And opening times are 9 a.m. till 5 p.m. primarily throughout the season. But if it gets quiet during January and February, we may close a little bit earlier, about 4 o'clock.
And are you only running trains at the weekends?
At the moment, we're running every weekend. Once we get to the new year, we then stop until the February half term. And that's initially to allow us to undertake most of our maintenance that we need to do, because basically that's the only time of the year that we're not running trains on a fairly regular basis.
You're just the Bristol contingent of a much larger industry, really, aren't you? The Heritage Railway industry. How's it going?
It's actually going very well. I think we've bucked the trend throughout the country, and the Heritage Railways that I've spoken to in recent months have all been indicating that they are actually performing very well. There are over 100 Heritage Railways throughout the country, and whilst we're not the largest, we do very well based on the size that we are. But some of the other railways, some of the larger ones, such as the Severn Valley Railway, the Great Central Railway, North Yorkshire Moors, I think they have some, you know, major plans for the future to develop. But of course, they need to continue developing because of the cost of actually keeping our heritage alive and keeping the steam trains going. It's not a cheap hobby. Obviously, this is what it all started out as in the early years, but that hobby now, for a lot of people, has changed into a major business.
Well, and a livelihood. But what draws you to it?
I've always had an interest in transport in general. And I, like a lot of youngsters, started collecting train numbers standing on the end of Temple Meads platform. And after a while, I was looking for something else to get involved with. A friend of mine knew about the Bitton Railway, as it was then, and introduced me to the railway. I got involved helping as a volunteer. And it's amazing because that was actually over 3 decades ago now. And I've been here for over 30 years. A lot of that as a volunteer in recent years, as a paid member of staff looking at the development of the railway. And I'm sure the future of the railway is very secure now.
This is the $64,000 question. How many years until you get to the outskirts of Bath? What's your best guess?
It is very much down to how quickly we can finance it, rather than the ability to actually do the work. I would like to think that it's going to be within the next decade, but it's very much down to the support that we get from the local authority and from opportunities for us to generate large sums of money, whether it be through income from our trading activity, from grants, donations, bequests, whatever it may be.
That's David Cole there, and you can find the Avon Valley Railway at Bitton Railway Station, Bath Road, Bitton in Bristol. The phone number 0117 932 5538. That's 0117 932 5538. 5538. But that's not the only heritage railway around here. There's a relatively new one down at Midsummer Norton on the way out on the Wells Road on the right hand side, the road to Wells. I don't think it's actually called Wells Road, from Midsummer Norton, which is only a short bit of track, but they've got steam trains down there over Christmas. There's also the much better known Severn Valley Railway up in Kidderminster, but that's quite a long drive up north up the M5. Another one is the Forest of Dean Railway, really beautiful surroundings there, over the Severn Bridge, up a little bit, you turn right basically, you go over the Severn Bridge and you'll find the Forest of Dean Railway.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Groovy little tune that, cooling you down. But now, to heat you up, it's Jeff Sparks with the What's On Guide.
Thank you, Tony. This is a What's On Guide from Dialect. Starting with Friday, 13th of December, Beth Rowley will be performing at the Folk House in Park Street at Bristol. Tickets are £13 each and doors open at 7:30 p.m. Also on 13th of December, the Madness tribute group, Nuttiness, will be performing at the Tunnels in Bristol and Exeter Mews, Bristol. Tickets are £5 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. On to Song of the Week, and I present Charlie Drake. He was a comedian, actor, writer and singer with a career that spanned over 50 years. This is a song that he recorded in 1963 and is titled I've Lost the End of My Yodel.
Oh, lady. Oh, lady. Gah. Oh, lady. Gah.
Aha! Whatever's wrong?
I've lost the end of my yodel.
Ah!
Mary Lou, come back. I'll tell you how it happened. I was climbing through a cloud and the wind was blowing loud and the mountainside was wet and slippery. I looked up to give a yodel like a Tyrolean yokel. Then I slipped and ripped my yodel lady. I lost the end of my yodel. I'd a lady, old lady. Whatever will I do? What will become of me? A yodel without an end is like a whistle without a peal. Lost the end of my yodel lady. Mary Lou, come back. Everything'll be all right. It's wonderful what they can do nowadays. Oh dear. If there's anyone out there with a yodel they can spare, with a little end of one of me, I just slipped and fell, it's tragic. Lost my little bit of magic. Lost the end of my yodel lady. She's done gone. Perhaps it's just as well. Just goes to show she only wanted to marry me for my yodel. Lost the end of my yodel lady.
That was Charlie Drake with I've Lost the End of My Yodel, which was recorded in 1963. Moving into Saturday, 14th of December, Happy Mondays will be performing with support from the Sunshine Underground and Salk at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol, as part of their 25th anniversary tour. Tickets are £28.50 in advance and doors open at 7 p.m. Finally, on Sunday, 15th of December, Bad Manners will be performing with support from Max Splodge at the Fleece in St Thomas Street, Bristol. Tickets are £18 in advance and doors open at 7:30 p.m. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a good week. Take care and goodbye.
Thanks, Jeff. Fantastic selection of music there. Can you give us a yodel?
No, best not.
Maybe break the studio or something.
Probably would do, yeah.
Anyway, thanks very much. That's all for this week. Dialects, a weekly podcast via MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 11 a.m. every Thursday morning. If you're online, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Tuesday evening when Dialect goes online. You can do that or download this weekly podcast from dialectradio1word.co.uk. Dialect's a Bristol Broadband Co-op production and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to, do please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. You'll find them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. That was Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
I really can't
but
stay.
But baby, it's cold outside.
I've got to go
but
away.
But baby, it's cold outside.
This evening has
been hoping that you drop
so
in.
Nice.
I'll hold your hands, they're just like
my
ice.
My mother will start to
beautiful, worry. What's your
my father will be pacing the floor.
Listen to the fireplace
so
roar.
Really, I'd better
beautiful,
hurry.
Please don't
well,
hurry.
Maybe just a half a drink.
Put
more.
Some records on while I
the
pour.
Might
baby, it's bad out there.
Say, what's in this
no
drink?
Cabs to be had out there. Your eyes are like starlight now. I'll take your hat, your hair looks swell.
I'll say no, no.
Mind
no,
if I move in close?
At least I'm gonna say that I try.
What's the sense of hurting my pride?
Really,
oh, baby, don't hold out. Baby, it's cold outside. Baby, it's cold outside.
The welcome has
how
been
lucky that you dropped
so
in.
Nice and warm.
Look out the window at the storm.
My sister will be suspicious.
Gosh, your lips look
my
delicious.
My brother will be there at the door.
Waves upon the tropical shore.
My maiden asks, mind is
gosh, vicious. Your lips are delicious.
Or maybe just a cigarette more.
Never such a blizzard before.
I've got to get home.
But baby, you'd freeze out there.
Say, lend me a coat.
It's up to your knees out there.
You've really been
I
great.
I thrill when you touch my
but
hair.
Don't you see?
How can you do this thing to
there's
me?
There's bound to be talk tomorrow.
Think of my lifelong
at
sorrow.
At least there will be plenty in blood.
If you caught pneumonia and
I really can't
get
stay.
Over that old doubt. Baby, it's cold. Baby, it's cold outside.